This Week in Virology, the podcast about viruses, the kind that make you sick. This Week in Virology, episode number 103, recorded October 15th, 2010. Hi, everybody. I'm Vincent Racaniello, and it's time for your weekly podcast about viruses. Joining me today from Western Massachusetts is Alan Dove.
Good to be here.
How are you?
Oh, doing just fine.
Was not too far from you recently.
That's right. Yeah, we unfortunately weren't able to meet up.
Beautiful place out there, I must say.
Yeah, there are some advantages to being in the boondocks.
The Berkshires are really beautiful, and we had great weather. Today we have a special guest, and that's L.J. Tan, Dr. L.J. Tan from the American Medical Association. Welcome to TWIV, L.J.
Well, hi. Thank you very much for the welcome, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Hey, I'm glad you could join us. Now, you are the Director of Infectious Disease for the AMA, is that correct?
That is correct. I'm also Director of Medicine and Public Health here as well. The Infectious Disease Program is actually under the Medicine and Public Health Division, which I direct. So it gets confusing.
We are at a college of the same name, aren't we? Columbia College.
Oh.
I'm at Columbia University, but one of the colleges is called Columbia College.
Oh, Columbia College. No, I used to teach there part-time. I stopped now.
In Chicago, is that where you are?
Yeah, in Chicago. Yeah, I'm in Chicago, and I used to teach part-time at the Columbia College, just kind of teaching kids, basic science.
Great.
To keep my skills intact.
You don't do that. You don't do that anymore, though?
No, I stopped. I stopped at, I think, 2007. My workload here at the AMA just got a little bit too much, and I just couldn't prepare a class. Yeah. Teach it and still carry on here. So
it's too bad because it's probably good for them to hear you.
Yeah, it's nice. It's fun. So I go back once in a while for a guest presentation, but it would have been nice. It was a human health and disease class. You know, so it was a whole semester where we spent, this first half talking about basic biology and immunology, and then right. We go and talk about infection, and then the last part is how the immune system deals with infection. So it was actually kind of fun.
Great.
I wish I could still do it. You're right. I mean, it's just time.
Their loss.
Thanks.
What we can do today is explain all of that, explain what the AMA is to our listeners and what it is that you do, and talk about vaccines in general and in specific. And so that should be very interesting. So you're a policy guy, basically, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's good. So let me just, if I can, just kind of, sure. Tell people what the AMA is all about. So, there are probably some myths that can be cleared up, hopefully, that I'll be able to do. The American Medical Association actually is, we call it a federation of medicine. So, we have individual members, so that's individual physicians, but we also have what we call specialty society members. So the American Academy of Pediatrics would be what we call a specialty society. They represent the specialists, such as pediatricians in this case. And they're also members of the so-called Federation of Medicine under the AMA. And so we actually serve as a gathering ground for a lot of the medical discussion, medical talks, and so on and so forth, among the specialties and as well as the individual physicians. And what I do is I'm actually Director of Medicine Public Health, and the Infectious Disease Program is a program that's inside Medicine Public Health. And so what we do is we provide guidance, education, information, meetings. We do a lot of convening functions for physicians as well as for our specialties as well as for external partners, such as the Infectious Diseases Society of America is one, the American Public Health Association would be another. But we would all get together and talk about policy, and specifically my major interest has always been influenza policy, and the idea is that the policy guides how physicians will practice or will guide the practice of medicine, that our physicians are the environment that our physicians are involved. So that's kind of where I am. That's kind of where I sit. Do a lot of national policy work. It's exciting. It's different. A chance to kind of touch base with a lot of different things.
But you have training. You have basic science training, right?
Yes, absolutely. I have a master's in molecular biology and a PhD in microbiology and immunology. The PhD is from Northwestern University Medical School. Uh-huh. And in fact, I was actually a bench scientist for a good part of my life until I decided that I wanted to see where the PhD could take me. And so that's kind of where I went off to.
So the AMA is sort of like a professional association. Would that be fair?
Yes, that would be fair.
because I'm a member of the American Society for Microbiology, which probably is not as large, but it's a similar professional association. We hold meetings, we publish journals. I presume the AMA does similar things, right?
Absolutely. So on the professional side, the professional education side, we do publish, obviously, the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Right.
And it's an editorially independent journal, but it is associated with the AMA. And we do publish other journals in different specialties as well. And the group that I'm in, called the Professional Standards Group at the AMA, actually is the professional wing of the AMA. So the AMA is obviously a professional association, but as many of listeners might have heard, we also do a lot of other work to protect the environment of practice for physicians, that which sometimes makes people think that we're not professional, but we're a trade association. So we're actually a bit of both. And where I am is entirely professional. We do education, things like that.
So I guess membership is voluntary for American physicians, right?
Yes, it is. You do not have to be an AMA to do anything concerned with medicine in the United States. So
okay. I remember my dad was a member and he was a physician. What fraction of physicians? Do you have any idea in the U.S. or members?
So we have both internists, we have residents, we have medical students, and we have obviously practicing physicians as part of our membership. So when you combine all the numbers together, we represent about 27% of physicians and physicians in training.
Hmm. Probably would like to get that higher, I would guess, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a tough environment now for all professional associations, and I think the AMA is no different. I mean, I think we're all struggling with issues of membership, because of the recession is one big deal,
right.
Is one big part. And the AMA does a lot of things for physicians that they will benefit from, even though they don't become members. And I think part of our challenge is to kind of show the value equation for them for becoming a member.
Right.
Right. Why buy the cow if you can get the milk for free?
Exactly. There you go, Al. So that's the problem. So I think we're trying to increase that value proposition to our membership. But but as we go on, we still do a lot of things. I mean, as Alan will testify, he helped us with the National Influenza Vaccine Summit, which just ended in May. A huge meeting, the only meeting in the United States where we bring together all the stakeholders on influenza immunization to talk honestly and clearly about what's coming, what we need to do. But that whole meeting is hosted by the AMA for free. People go for free. There's no registration fee. So, physicians and non-physicians get the benefit of what we do regardless of membership. It's a difficult, it's a difficult proposition because you're thinking, it's something that's important for public health. You don't necessarily want to put a price tag on.
So you also have things for the public as well as for physicians.
Well, our target audience is the physician, but yeah. As there's so much crosstalk on that now. I mean, there are a lot of members of the public that will go to the AMA website, find materials that we intend for physicians and use them.
Right.
And great, we owe no power to them for doing that. So absolutely, we target physicians, but we anticipate, we know that a significant of our audience is the public.
So this influenza summit, vaccine summit that you mentioned, the public was able to attend that?
No, public was not invited. Mm-hmm. It was a closed meeting, but obviously all the proceedings from the meeting and all the information and all the efforts that come out of that meeting are open to the public.
Okay.
Partly because the CDC is a member, is a co-sponsor of that meeting with us. So when you have the feds involved, it's open to the public.
So Alan, right, did you go to that meeting?
I remotely. So one of the things I do these days, I used to do a lot of conference coverage that involved traveling to conferences and then writing up what happened. And that was fine. It was good business. But then as technology progressed, I tried a couple of times doing conferences remotely where people will give me either a video link to the conference live or they'll send video or audio files and PowerPoints. And I essentially reconstruct the meeting after the fact. And then I stand here at my desk, right in my own office and write up the meeting from that. And that actually has gone so well that that's my primary way of covering meetings. Is I stay here in Western Massachusetts and I cover meetings that are all over the place. It's cheaper for the organizers, if they're paying a writer, they don't then also have to pay to fly them to wherever and put me up and feed me and all that. And pay my bar tab, of course.
Must be huge.
Yeah.
No problem.
So you,
it worked out really well. So I'm delighted. So
you covered this meeting, and did you write about it somewhere?
Yeah. So I, in fact, I just checked the website. I see that the write up is up there.
This is the National Influenza Vaccine
PreventInfluenza.org. They have the Influenza Vaccine Summit. And so I wrote up, you know, kind of tried to summarize. There was an enormous amount of material presented, and then, of course, my job is to condense all that into something that somebody can read, you know, in less than their lunch break. So that's all up and online now.
So this page, if you click on National Influenza Vaccine Summit on the right, is that the page you're...
If you go down to the left to summit meetings.
I see. I see executive summary.
And then meeting minutes underneath that. So I wrote those things.
Very good.
So you can download PDFs about it.
Great. Well, so what was this meeting about, LJ?
So the meeting is every year. And I think, you know, more importantly, what is the summit about? The summit actually is one of those unique situations where we are able to bring in, you know, all the stakeholders who are interested in, you know, advancing influenza immunization rates, because, as you know, I mean, our coverage is far below what we want. You know, even if you look at Healthy People 2010 goals, let alone Healthy People 2020 goals, which are coming up. And so the summit brings people together. You know, initially it was in response to vaccine supply crisis, but now it's more, you know, as our vaccine supply has stabilized, largely because of the work of the summit, we're now at the point where we want to try to kind of, you know, help people reach the new goal of universal vaccination for influenza in the United States. And so that's what the summit brings together. And we meet every year, and what we do every year is we kind of take a look back at the previous season. And obviously this year's look back was extremely fascinating. and then kind of learn from that, and then take that forward into the upcoming season and say, hey, so what do we have to focus on? And obviously this upcoming season, you know, a lot of the discussion, as Alan will recall, was on, you know, how do we take the lessons we learned from the pandemic outbreak and move it into what we now have as a universal recommendation. You know, everybody in the United States over 6 months of age is supposed to get vaccinated. And so the question is, how do you move forward in accomplishing that goal, which is a very, you know, difficult goal because of the fact that influenza vaccination is, for most Americans, for a lot of Americans, is what we call a vaccine of convenience.
Yeah. What was the coverage last year? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, we do, actually. So seasonal coverage actually turned out to be pretty good. We for the first time in history, we actually used up all the seasonal influenza vaccine that we had. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up getting a coverage of close to about, you know, 40%. But the H1N1 coverage was far worse, was much more dismal.
Mm-hmm. Is that because of the supply?
Yeah, that was because of the supply. Mm-hmm. The supply and demand didn't really overlap, as you'll recall.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and that's challenging because of the fact that, you know, we revved a lot of people up, you know, with predictions of, you know, we would have vaccine by early October, you know, some more favorable prognosis had it available in September. So everybody got revved up, and then, you know, then they were made to wait. And then when the vaccine became available, it also became available at the same time as everybody started realizing that, you know, we might have really lucked out with this pandemic, and that this strain, while it was causing causing death and mortality, and morbidity, it wasn't as severe as we had all predicted it to be. And so I think there's a lot of reaction to that as well, and we kind of lost a lot of the momentum going forward. So, you know, by the end of the season, I think the CDC estimates what about 27% actually received H1N1 vaccination, compared to obviously the 40% that I mentioned earlier for seasonal.
Yeah. Did that pandemic emergence last year take you by surprise?
No, not really. I mean, I think what took us by surprise was how different it came out is, you know, to our assumptions when we planned. As you know, we've been planning for a pandemic since probably 2005 when HHS actually launched the full plan to the states to kind of implement. So I think we've all been waiting. You know, we all felt it was overdue. We knew it was coming. We had some very strong assumptions based on previous pandemics and based on just the evolution of influenza, we anticipated it would come from Asia. We anticipated we would have reaction time because of the fact that it would have to travel across the globe. And what took us totally by surprise was it did not evolve in Asia. It came from Mexico, and it was in California within days. Mm-hmm. And then the rapidity at which it swept across not just the United States but also the globe, I think, took us all by surprise as well. I think the marvel of modern travel, I think, has its disadvantages, and I think in the last year's pandemic kind of showed us one of those disadvantages. I mean, it just went right across the planet really quickly. And again, the good news again was that, you know, it wasn't extremely virulent. I mean, you know, I say that very sympathetic and very sensitive to the fact that, you know, that we did lose, you know, a lot of people. But it could have been far worse. So it was almost like a dry run for us.
Hmm. Here on TWIV, we felt the impact. We had a lot of activity, a lot of involvement of people because of the pandemic outbreak. We had lots of questions, and most of them were reasonable, but a good fraction of people, maybe Alan can agree or not, were very suspicious of it. They felt that it wasn't necessary to be immunized, it wasn't that serious, and it was all manufactured to sell vaccine. So how do you deal with that kind of sentiment?
Yeah, you know, and we still hear that a lot, which is kind of, you know, unfortunate, because, you know, I think we're dealing with a certain amount of influenza fatigue right now. Mm. But I think absolutely. I think, you know, I think there's some very strong vocal groups out there who are not particularly keen on immunizations in general, and influenza immunization provides a very visible target. And I think there was a lot of fear because, you know, the idea that, you know, this was, we had, because of timing of the way the evolution of H1N1 turned out, we couldn't combine it into the seasonal vaccine. And so the idea of a second vaccination kind of threw some people, which then also set up this expectation that, oh, is this a brand new vaccine? Is this something that's just, you know, some people called it experimental?
Yeah.
And truth be told, it wasn't. I mean, the vaccine essentially was approved the way seasonal vaccine is approved every year. It's made the same way, it was made the same, in the same fashion as seasonal influenza vaccine. And as hard as we tried to get that out there, I think there was enough hype that we probably weren't as successful as we would have liked to have been regarding that little bit of misinformation. I think the other thing that we did do, though, you know, nationally, is that the surveillance for safety of this vaccine was enormous. There was a lot of additional resources. We already do a lot in terms of vaccine safety surveillance, but for this specific, you know, pandemic vaccine, the 2009 H1N1 vaccine, there was an enormous amount of surveillance that was done for it. An entire new vaccine safety working group was set up within the National Vaccine Advisory Committee to specifically just monitor H1N1. And the good news is that there was nothing to be worried about. But the bad news was there was a lot of resources that was put into that. So, but I think it helps public confidence to know that the vaccine was monitored so strenuously.
So there were no particular side effects associated with immunization with that?
No, not at all.
Because
not
I know some people were concerned about Guillain-Barré because the last swine.
Guillain-Barré.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we tried to point out at the beginning of the season that, you know, with the immunization season for H1N1, that, you know, the vaccine is not, 1976 was made differently from the vaccine that we use currently. And so GBS, or Guillain-Barré syndrome, was only seen specific to that one pandemic flu vaccine from 1976. If you look at all the surveillance we've done with seasonal vaccine after that, we've not seen a signal there. And the good news is we didn't see a signal with 2009 H1N1 either. And I think what we've always got to realize, and I think one of the hardest things to get out to the public, is that you will see a signal of GBS just because of the fact that you gave the vaccine to so many million people. Mm-hmm. The point is, you know, and this is that whole idea of trying to explain the scientific method, is the point is whether that signal is above your control, which is what is the normal rate of GBS in the population. And so I think that's the challenge of explaining to the public, you know, and what happens is that a lot of folks who are interested in stirring up misinformation will say, yeah, there were 23 cases associated with, you know, with the immunization program for 2009 H1. I'm throwing numbers out now. These are not true, not accurate. But then if you expect 23 million cases anyway because of the number of people that you're sampling, then that's actually essentially background.
Sure.
So right. I think that's a hard thing to explain to people.
Right. Those were people who would have gotten it anyway.
Correct. Exactly. They would have gotten it anyway in the background. And so I think it's one of those challenges to explain. And I think, you know, it's you know, I think on the general point, and you probably all have already touched on this in previous shows, I would bet, is this idea that scientific literacy is not great in the United States.
Yeah.
It could be much better.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we don't mean to insult anyone, but if you're not taught in school how to do science properly, it's hard to understand. And particularly, the personal issues cloud you. So if your child has a seizure after immunization, it's very hard for you to set aside the possibility that it would have happened anyway.
It's you're absolutely right. You know, one of my favorite slides that I use in a vaccine safety risk management talk I give is this idea of what is causal association. You know, and I think it's we're evolved to, we evolved to kind of respond to these kind of threats because you know it's about survival of the species. So it's a false positive. You know, is far, you know, you want to take that into account far more than you do a false negative. And so because, you know, it's the whole idea of if you're a caveman and you hear a noise and you assume it's a wild animal about to eat you and you run away, you survive to populate your gene pool. Right. But if you hear the noise and you assume the false negative, which is that it's nothing, it's just wind blowing through the trees, and it turns out to be a bear and it eats you, your gene pool is gone. You know, you've lost your contribution to the gene pool. So, you know, in a similar manner, we evolved to think that way. And so, one of my examples that I give is that, you know, it's kind of interesting that there are 7 years in which the University of Kentucky basketball team won the NCAA championship, and those same 7 years, the Yankees won the World Series. So is it fair to say that the next time the University of Kentucky wins the NCAA championship, then that your Yankees are going to win the World Series? Obviously not. And everyone would laugh when I say that. But that's the same kind of association we're dealing with when, let's say, I give influenza vaccination and some child has a febrile seizure the next day. I mean, it's not a causal association. It's a temporal association. But we're trying to, you know, one does not necessarily cause the other.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot, association versus causation. And I think a part of the problem is that scientists say, well, it's difficult to prove causation and we need time. And the public says, we don't have time. We need to know right away.
So yeah, you're right. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, they're not patient. Science, as you know, is very slow, sometimes glacially slow. And the public doesn't buy it, especially now the whole chronic fatigue syndrome viral etiology. The scientists are saying we need time to be sure, and the patients are saying, you've had enough time. Give us the answers, you know.
Give me the antiviral.
Right.
Exactly. And that is not the way it works, as you know. You need to really – the scientific process is very slow, and I think only scientists can really understand it because they've done it.
Yeah, and I think one of the challenges is that we're in a society that, as you've suggested, you know, does not accept that. And I think we need to, you know, for the policy side and the information sharing side, I think what scientists, we all need to try to figure out is how comfortable are we in saying something and being comfortable enough to come back fairly rapidly and say, I made a mistake that was based on the most current data. The data has now changed and this is the new situation. And I think we're learning how to do that a little bit better, but I think there's an inherent discomfort in scientists to do that. I mean, it's the whole idea of we never say never, right? I mean, but unfortunately, when we don't do that and we're up against, let's say, you know, information campaigns in the public come back and say, well, why don't you just say that it doesn't cause GBS? Well, as a scientist, I can't say that because, as what you've mentioned, the causal associations are really hard to disprove or prove. So what I do is I use words like the data does not support an association between influenza immunization and Guillain-Barré syndrome. And that just sounds like I'm hedging my bet.
Right, exactly.
You know, and it doesn't work in the public. So we need to figure a way to say that, you know, that in a much more conclusive and definitive fashion within our comfort zones.
Yeah.
The public really does not like that kind of a statement. You're absolutely right. They think we're waffling or hedging when in fact that's all you can say based on the data.
Yeah, but I was very impressed particularly with the CDC talks at the meeting, where they were going into their surveillance efforts on the pandemic and seasonal flu vaccines. And, you know, typical CDC job, they really just dove right into it and just monitored everything, every piece of data that they could possibly get their hands on. For any sign of you know, unusual rates of anything, especially Guillain-Barré, given the history of the swine flu vaccine. You know, it seemed like they were really, it wasn't just, oh, we don't have any reports of it. It was, they were actually going out and really looking for reports of it. It was a very impressive job.
Well, they did an incredible collaboration with the neurologists around the country to essentially open up and look into all the records there from, you know, just to see whether there was any blip in GBS, and there wasn't. I mean, you know, Alan, to be a little bit funny about it, you know, that's your tax dollars at work.
Exactly.
But, you know, it's, you know, and it's great. I think it's necessary. But, you know, you think about all that money that went into that, and, you know, and hopefully we'll be able to learn from that and take that into the future. And, you know, because I know they've adapted some of those same surveillance mechanisms for the seasonal flu now. They're not going to do it in such a extensive amount, but there's going to be very good monitoring again of influenza vaccination and adverse events, and I think that's a good thing.
Right.
LJ, you mentioned that the 1976 vaccine was made differently. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, you know, the production I don't know the entire process for 76, but the current process, you know, the egg-based process was not what was used back then. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to understand some of the differences in the virology that resulted in creating the pandemic, the 1976 swine flu viral strain that was in the vaccine versus the antigenic components that are used in the seasonal as well as the H1N1 vaccine. So in other words, the whole viruses versus antigenic components. And I think, you know, helping folks understand that there are differences in the methodology when you do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, whole virus vaccines obviously are very different.
Sure. So you are also on the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. That is correct.
ACIP, which I've known about for many years. I worked on polio vaccines and went to several meetings of the ACIP. I don't think we've ever talked about that. Can you just tell us what that is and what it does?
So I'm actually a member on the outside ring, I like to call it, of the ACIP, and the outside ring is essentially what they call the liaison and ex officio members. In other words, we are not elected; we are actually nominated by the organizations that are represented. So, for example, the AMA, I represent the AMA on the ACIP. Opposed to obviously what's in the inside ring, which are the actually elected members. So these are folks who serve 4-year terms, but because the outside ring, the members from the organizations don't serve specific term lengths, they're actually there for a long time, and they actually serve as the institutional memory, I like to say, for the ACIP. So the ACIP is the group that advises the CDC. They're basically immunization experts from all around the country. On the outside ring, we even have immunization experts from Mexico, Canada, and the United Kingdom participating as well, so that we can learn from their experiences. And they advise the CDC whenever there's a change in the way a vaccine should be used, when there's a new vaccine that needs recommendations, and so on and so forth. So they actually advise the CDC with those recommendations. So, like, for example, the new recommendation that the CDC is now coming out with, that everybody over the age of 6 months should receive influenza immunization, that's a recommendation that came from the ACIP. It was provided to the CDC, and then the CDC had to evaluate it and decide that they wanted to implement it, and that's where we are now.
Oh, I see. So they now, don't... Sorry, go ahead.
Good. Yeah, that's obviously, you know, a very important process, but I gather it's not a very... This is not a group that leaps to conclusions, is it?
No, absolutely not.
I'm thinking in particular of one of the talks at the meeting that sort of relayed the history of getting to this universal recommendation for flu vaccine, and it's something that apparently the idea has been kicking around for a long time, and the consensus seemed to be, well, maybe we'll make that a universal recommendation someday. And now finally we have it in the wake of the H1N1 pandemic. Is that kind of typical? The ACIP is very deliberative about these sorts of things?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even more so now. In fact, it was funny. I was actually interviewed for a story that was on NPR Boston that was very similar to the question here, Alan. It's interesting how the ACIP works. And for influenza, it's exactly how you describe it. It's one of those things because it's an older vaccine. We've had the vaccine for a long time. And the ACIP spends a lot of time gathering the data. And remember, as Vincent said, you know, we're scientists are slow. And in the ACIP, in many ways, is science-based. So what they're looking for is accumulating evidence of who needs to be protected against influenza. And so what happened was, if you look at the evolution of the recommendation for influenza vaccination, it was very stepwise. The first piece of data showed who should get vaccinated, obviously the elderly. Then the next piece showed that there were people with chronic conditions that needed to be vaccinated, and so on and so forth. And what happened was the recommendations continued to swell until, you know, before this year, we had, you know, off the top of my head, I think it was like about 11 or 12 groups that were recommended for influenza immunization that essentially covered, you know, 85% of the population. And so it became to a point where, whereas the ACIP looked at this last year following the pandemic and said, so what did the pandemic show us? And what the pandemic showed us, there were two more groups that were vulnerable to influenza, and that is Native Americans were dramatically impacted, as well as obesity turned out to be a risk factor for mortality and influenza. And they said, so do we want to add those two as well? And by the time you added those two, you're vaccinating the entire population. So it was a small step to essentially go and say, you know, at this point in time, we might as well make the universal recommendation because, you know, data supports it. We're essentially got data on every piece of the population to the point where we can cover the entire population. And then finally, this whole idea of what we want to call protecting the vulnerable by vaccinating their contacts has always been a mantra. So it wasn't a big step to say, you know what, it's time that we made the leap and recommend a universal vaccination.
Is this? I guess the CDC is not obligated to take their advice, correct?
They are not. It's very rare that the CDC does not take mm-hmm. the advice of the ACIP, but they are not obligated to do so. It's a good recommendation. I have to emphasize this. It simplifies immunizations for everybody out there. Because one of the biggest challenges and one that the physicians and providers complain about is the fact that with the complexity of the immunization, you know, recommendations for influenza before this, they just didn't know who to vaccinate and they didn't have time to ask all the questions to identify whether this person was or was not in a risk group. Mm. Now, essentially, if you're over 6 months of age and you don't have an egg allergy, you get vaccinated.
Is there anyone who is excluded? Is there any specific health problem that would exclude you from being immunized?
So if you had GBS GBS within, I think, 12 weeks from your from a previous influenza immunization, that's the other contraindication. But otherwise, no.
And which vaccine is this? This is the inactivated vaccine,
this
correct?
This is the inactivated vaccine. So this is the one that's injected. Now, there's the FluMist or the live attenuated influenza vaccine that goes through the nose. That is a live virus vaccine, but that's a really fascinating live virus vaccine because of the genetic engineering that went into it. It's not a live virus vaccine the way you think of, like with measles or mumps or varicella, where you essentially have an attenuated live virus. With the FluMist, it's actually a genetically attenuated live virus that's been engineered to reproduce effectively at 34 degrees, but to essentially die at 37 degrees, which is obviously your internal body temperature. So it reproduces in the mucosal membranes of your nasal passages, which is where you introduce the vaccine. But then if it gets in deeper into the body system where the body temperature rises, it turns itself off. And so it reproduces effectively at 34 degrees, which is the temperature of your nasal passages, and then dies when it goes deeper. So it's a really remarkable vaccine virus.
Who should receive that vaccine, or who shouldn't, maybe we should say?
So I think it's recommended for anybody between the ages of 2 years and 49 years of age who are healthy. So healthy adults, essentially, and children.
And how does the fraction of people who get that compare with the other vaccine in the U.S.? Must be
so
much
it is much less. I think there's a lot of outreach that still needs to be done regarding the vaccine. I think there's a lot of people who are still concerned about giving it to people if they are in contact with someone who's immunocompromised, for example. And that's absolutely okay. If you, you know, the only situation where you don't want to give it to somebody is if that person is in contact with someone that's actually in immunization, it's in isolation because of immunosuppression. And that's very rare. There are people who are afraid of giving it to somebody because their partner or their spouse or someone in their family, for example, may be HIV positive. No, you can. You should absolutely vaccinate. I mean, so I think because of these questions about the fact that it is a quote-unquote live virus, we've got some education to still do on that issue.
And it's also not as well known.
That's true. It's not as well known. I think it's getting better in terms of the pediatric population, because obviously pediatricians love this vaccine because it doesn't involve a shot.
Yeah. In fact, my daughter just got it this week.
And she probably loved it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We went. In fact, I didn't even know last year the pediatrician didn't have flu mist. And so we scheduled the flu shot. And, you know, I kind of told my daughter about it. She's five. So, you know, I don't want a flu shot. Okay, well, honey, you got to do this every year. And we got there and I found out they had flu mist. And I said, hey, can we get that? and she got it. She thought it was just the funniest thing in the world.
Tickle.
I got a shot in my nose.
That's great.
You know, that's so funny, Alan, because that's exactly how I described it to my 13-year-old, but she was one of the first kids to get the flu mist. And I was telling her, because the first indication was 5 and over, because they only went down to 2 about 2 years ago. And I was telling her, because I was really excited, I said, guess what, Jerrica, you don't have to, get the shot in the arm anymore. And it now goes in your nose. And she absolutely freaked out. And I couldn't wonder why. And then it turned out she thought she was going to get a needle in her nose.
Right.
And I went, oh, you know, there's the communication problems, right? I mean, we, you know, with so many things that we just don't pay attention to our language. And, you know, and I think that's part of the flu mist problem, too. I think they need to just keep on communicating its presence and its utility.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a lot of places it's just not available. I went the same day and got my shot at the local drugstore. And they only had, I guess I got Fluvirin. It doesn't bother me, but people who want the flu mist, well, if you go to the drugstore, you're probably out of luck.
Yeah. I'm hoping that it's beginning to turn the corner because, as you know, at the summit, Alan, we have the reports from all the manufacturers, how many doses they're bringing to the market every year. And the good news is that MedImmune, which is now owned by AstraZeneca, has continually reported every year that they're bringing more and more doses. And I have to believe that they wouldn't be doing that if they didn't see the demand for their vaccine increasing.
Right.
So I'm hoping that we're turning a corner on that because it's an invaluable vaccine because, you know, it's great for healthy people. Healthcare workers can get it, who are healthy, obviously, and direct contacts, you know, who are under the age of 50 can get it.
We're not trying to advertise it or anything.
No, the
shot works just as well, and I gather another barrier to flu mist. Actually, one of its disadvantages was at least at first it was significantly more expensive.
Yes, and it's still more expensive.
So depending on what your insurance covers,
Now both vaccines are produced in chicken eggs, correct?
That is correct.
And I understand that in Europe there is a cell-based vaccine. So do you have any sense for when cell-based flu vaccines might come to the U.S.?
I think faster than you think. There are two manufacturers in the United States that have already, they're in the final phases of completing their cell-based facilities in the United States. So I think cell-based production is not that far away in the United States. I would say probably in the next year or 2 years from now, I think they'll be ready to start getting the FDA approval processes in place.
So
I think one of the challenges is that it will be considered a new vaccine.
Right.
So it will have to go through, obviously, the entire FDA approval process as well.
How long will that take?
There's a way to fast track this. So I can't predict and don't want to predict because I don't want to put words in the mouths of the FDA or any of the manufacturers, in fact. But hopefully, you know, it will take maybe a year, year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I can't predict the time frame. There is this rapid approval process that I'm sure they're going to put this through. But just, you know, it's kind of interesting, you know, the vaccines that are approved in the United, in the European Union aren't immediately, you know, they go through an entire approval process here in the United States as well.
Right. We actually talked about that a little bit with adjuvants last year, which there was an adjuvant that was approved in the EU, and the discussion was on putting it in. Should we put this in our H1N1 vaccine and make it go a lot further and address these supply problems? And not approved here. And I thought the CDC folks had a really interesting take on that. They did consider an emergency authorization to use it, but they had to weigh that against, the public was already a little dubious about this H1N1 vaccine, and do we want to go adding something under an emergency use, an adjuvant that hasn't been used in the U.S., and ultimately they went with an unadjuvanted vaccine, largely because of that, I gather.
Yeah, and also, the fact that the data also came out that you just need one shot, which really helped. And so, so the supply issue, the stress on the supply dropped dramatically after that. But you're absolutely right, Alan. I mean, last year, putting an emergency use authorization for adjuvants in there would have just totally scared a lot of the public, because it would have then added that whole experimental theme to it much more than it was already there. So you're absolutely. But there is an adjuvanted vaccine in Europe that's already being used.
Right.
So not only are they doing cell culture, which I think they started in 2006, they're also doing adjuvanted vaccines in Europe, and I think that was in 2008. So I mean they've been using adjuvanted influenza vaccines for several years now. So in many ways we're behind the eight ball here.
Right. And I guess the advantage to we've talked a little bit about cell-based vaccines. It gets you away from this egg allergy issue, and it also potentially speeds up the whole production process, right?
Yes. And again, I think it's going to be a combination of techniques that's going to change the production process. You're going to want to throw in things like reverse genetics, so you can reverse engineer a seed virus. And then obviously the cell culture will clean things up a lot. I think if you put all those together, hopefully you'll actually speed up production by maybe 2 to 3 months. And that would be phenomenal once we get that technology incorporated in the United States.
I was at a meeting last week where there was a lot of talk about flu vaccines, experimental flu vaccines that induce broadly neutralizing activity.
Yeah.
And the progress is actually amazing, where in the past 2 years now, broadly neutralizing antibodies have been identified that are directed against the stalk of the hemagglutinin. And it seems to me that maybe within the next 10 years, these will be a reality. Have you thought about those?
Yeah, and I think when you couple that with some of the other delivery technology, like virus-like particles that are out there, I think absolutely we're going to have, 10 years, probably. I mean, there's in addition, there's the M, there's also the matrix protein research that's going on as well. I'm optimistic that I think maybe 10 years. You're right. I think we'll probably have a universal influenza vaccine as opposed to a universal recommendation for influenza vaccination.
Right, so, and then it would become something that you got as your standard childhood series, and that would be it for flu.
Well, and probably a booster, I would probably say.
Right, it's at some point, probably. Yeah.
That would be great, because then you would even be covered in the event of a pandemic, new pandemic strain, you'd be covered, right? That would be fantastic.
Yeah,
all these logistic issues would be, and then I guess you'd have to find another job, LJ, right?
I'm looking forward to it. It's funny, when we started the summit back in 2001, I kept saying I want to be out of work with the summit, because that would mean we're fixed influenza immunization.
Right.
It's a long way coming still. I think.
Well, you work on other vaccines too.
Yes, we do. And we work on vaccine safety here and other things as well.
One thing,
but influenza is interesting. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
One thing we were interested in, and we talked a lot about last year, and I don't think we came up with a consensus, is what's the role of hand washing and face masks in limiting influenza transmission?
Boy, I wish there were great data on that, but there's not. But
So it's not just that we didn't find it.
No. It really is, because think of the study, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real hard study to do.
Yeah.
I mean, the groups that have tried to look at it, I think there was a study that was done, actually at Columbia University, I think a nursing group tried to do it. And because I ended up reviewing the paper for it for a journal, but I can't remember what happened then. Probably shouldn't be talking about it, sorry. But I think it's just the methodology is extremely difficult. A lot of confounding factors, but you kind of have to, believe in traditional interruption of transmission, and certainly using alcohol-based gels and hand washing frequently it will interrupt transmission. And I there is data to suggest that at least. So, but what's the impact is in terms of an influenza season is very hard to get concrete data on.
Does AMA make any recommendations?
Absolutely. We recommend that the best way to prevent influenza is to get the vaccine. And then in addition to that, we also recommend that everybody practice appropriate hand hygiene and cough hygiene. So cough into the sleeve, wash your hands frequently, regularly with hot water, warm water and soap. And the big one that a lot of us don't do is, because obviously, as I don't know if you know, but I'm speaking here with a sore throat. Stay home when you're sick.
Yes.
And obviously I'm working today. So I'm, it's one of those, learn from practice what I preach, not what I do.
Yeah.
But so we do have a lot of policy on that.
Well, just don't let anyone else use your microphone. That's all.
Exactly. We don't think that it's a one size fit all. I don't think you can just, you want to get vaccinated. That's the best way. But additionally, the hand hygiene is extremely important as well.
Well, and general things like hand hygiene will protect you against more than just flu. The vaccine is very effective for preventing flu, yes. But it's not the only disease out there.
No, in fact, influenza is probably, 20 to 30% of the respiratory illnesses that we have every fall, winter, and spring season. So, and I think that's actually, maybe that's an opportunity for me to tell your listeners that this is that whole concept of the myth that the vaccine gave me influenza. Is that the vaccine, as you said, Alan, protects you against influenza. And influenza is not the only respiratory virus out there. I mean, what I have right now is clearly a rhinovirus infection. Because if I had influenza, I'd be back on my, back at home in bed on my back, unable to get out of bed. So, but what happens is that I actually got my flu shot 5 days ago, so I could very easily say, flu shot gave me the flu, and it's, it's again, it's this whole idea of temporal association. So, but it's not, and I think if there's anything we can do is just to help shatter those myths, to the public that the flu shot doesn't get the flu vaccine. Vaccine doesn't give you influenza, and so what if you get this temporal association? It's some other respiratory virus,
most likely. Yeah,
yeah. Flu gets all the publicity, but there are plenty of other viruses that can give you respiratory. In addition to rhino, the coronas, the adenoviruses, the metapneumoviruses.
You know, Vince, somebody could do a weekly show about that.
We probably should think about it.
Well, in the military, they used to have an adenovirus vaccine.
Right.
Right.
I don't know if they still do, but they used to.
Yes, that's right. When I was in graduate school, we learned it was only for the military, one of those vaccines. But I'm not sure they use it. We've certainly talked about it. It's back in the archives there. I wanted to touch briefly on a different vaccine, but before we do, is there anything else you wanted to get into, Alan?
Yeah, I think, can I say something real fast about just making sure that people get out there and get vaccinated?
Absolutely.
As I said earlier, there's influenza fatigue. I think people are tired of hearing about, go get your flu shot. But there's a lot of, I want to point out these statistics. If we have 41% of the population still non-immune to H1N1, and we do have a new H3N2 strain that's circulating. And as we know, when H3N2 circulates predominantly, that's a very bad influenza season. That tends to be a bad influenza season. You couple those two factors together, there's a lot of potential risk for severe disease this year. I'm not worried at all about vaccine supply this year. I'm worried about vaccine disease if we don't vaccinate effectively this year. So I think that's a couple of things to think about as you go forward.
There will probably be less compliance this year, right? The post-pandemic year, people are, as you say, people are tired of it.
Yeah, and that's what we're worried about. We're worried the disease is going to be greater, not because of a lack of a vaccine, but because of the influenza fatigue.
Yeah, I heard someone say in a store, she was an older woman, and someone said, you're going to get your flu shot this year. And she said, no, I don't think so. I've had enough shots.
And if she's older, she definitely needed to get vaccinated.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where all our mortality is, anyway.
Yeah, that's that and the kids.
Yeah.
Actually, one of my picks of the week several weeks back was families fighting flu, which I think they make a particularly persuasive argument on this point.
Absolutely.
I wanted to just talk a few minutes on the current vaccine injury case that's before the Supreme Court. I'm sure that you have thought about, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it. This is a case of a vaccine injury claiming that the DPT immunization back in 92 caused a lot of problems. What's your thought? Yeah.
So legitimately, the original diphtheria, tetanus, and whole cell pertussis, what we now call the DTP or the DPT, was actually officially, you know, associated with seizures. With this case, I think what happened was that there was the seizures happened within a specific time frame. They're not random. And what happened with this case is that they actually filed through the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. But a couple of months before they filed, there's a table of injuries that qualifies what can be covered. The random seizure component was removed because the evidence did not support that. And I think so that kind of left this family a little bit, unfortunately, out of the loop there. And so what they then did was obviously they then filed suit against the manufacturer, which is at that point was Wyeth. And as you know, Wyeth has now been purchased by Pfizer. And so the case that has gone through all the courts, and this has been percolating for several years now, is finally at the Supreme Court, and they heard arguments, I believe, just a couple of days ago. And I think a couple of things to kind of just keep in mind is that this is not this case is going to hinge more or less on actually the logistics of interpretation of the law as opposed to anything else. And I think the big thing is that the family's attorneys are arguing is that there was, because the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program allows for the lawsuit if you can demonstrate that there was a better alternative that the manufacturer did not use. And I think what they're arguing that when this whole cell pertussis vaccine was given to the child, there was a safer vaccine, which is the so-called acellular pertussis vaccine. I think what's not commonly reported out there was that at the time that the whole cell was given to the girl, the acellular pertussis vaccine had not been approved by the FDA yet. So while the vaccine did exist, the manufacturer did have it, the manufacturer was not indicated for use because the FDA had not approved it. And if the FDA has not approved it, obviously the ACIP has not had a chance to make recommendations on its use either. And so I think if you look at that kind of the argument there, I think you're going to find that it's likely that it might swing in favor of the manufacturer. But right. It's an interesting case. I think I think a lot of people never heard about the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, and now it's finally out there.
One of the issues here, I think, is whether people will be able to sue vaccine manufacturers more than they have so far. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
So one of the issues is whether individuals will be able to sue vaccine manufacturers. I think one of the concerns is that if the Supreme Court rules in favor of this family, then many more individuals will sue vaccine manufacturers, and that'll impede the development of vaccines.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a concern that it might open up, the tidal wave of individual lawsuits because it opens the door of bypassing the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. The VICP was established to essentially take away that threat of liability from the manufacturers. So that's a fear. And as we know, in the mid 80s, when this started, we went from 20 something plus vaccine manufacturers down to four. Mm-hmm. And it was in response to that precipitous decline in research and development in vaccines that the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program was actually created as part of the act. And I think there's a lot of concern that we don't want to go back down that path again because, vaccines are a huge public health miracle. And so I think we want to make sure that we continue to do our R&D in that and continue to develop vaccines that are safe and effective.
Right.
So I think that's a big fear.
Yeah, and we've mentioned on TWIV before, I think, that even with these types of legal protections in place, in general, making vaccines is not a terribly profitable business relative to pharma, right?
No, absolutely not. And I think if you pull up figures for what is the marketing budget for a blockbuster drug, just as, let's say, Lipitor, off the top of my head here, sometimes you'll find that the marketing budget of the drug itself is greater than the entire revenue that a company will make from its vaccine portfolio. So I think it's remarkable.
But we can't, just to go back on this case a little bit, we can't be sure that the vaccine caused the seizures of this child, correct? It's just associated temporally.
Correct. And I think the point here is that in the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, what they create is they create a table of compensation, essentially, that says that if you have these symptoms after this specific vaccine, we will compensate you, because it is one of those side effects, adverse events that we know can be associated with a vaccine. So rather than go through the process, we will compensate you. And that's called the compensation table. Mm. And the point is that, so seizures after the whole cell pertussis is compensated, is compensatable, but it has to be, it's encephalopathy is the cause of that. And so as it turns out, there's no evidence that, that this child was having encephalopathy, but was just having random seizures.
I see.
And so as a result, causation can, you know, it's no longer immediately just automatically compensated off the table. Causality has to be shown, and so on and so forth. And obviously, the parents therefore took it out of the system and went right after the manufacturers.
But it should be, I guess, we should emphasize that the decision to remove that indication or that side effect had epidemiological support, right?
Absolutely, it's done by a committee. They look at the data and they make decisions as to what to add or take away from that table. And if you hear, there's a lot of folks out there who complain about these processes because of the fact that it's done by an expert panel, and the expert panel does not always have the public input that they feel that these panels should have, and so on and so forth. And I think there's saying that is totally within the realm of reason. I think one of the things we have to remind ourselves with these expert panels is that the decisions that they're making requires a certain amount of expertise. That's why they call expert panels. And I think to you need to be confident that these panels have the wherewithal and the know-how to say what they're saying. And I personally would be a little troubled if there were too many people on the panel who weren't vaccinologists and making recommendations to me or to the or for the injury compensation program.
Right.
So I think that's something that we want to, it's a tough balance, but I think at policy levels we're trying to really tiptoe that balance, because we want public input, we want the public to feel they're part of the process, part of the decisions, but at the same time there's a certain point where you just can't, and it's a very fine line that we're trying to tiptoe.
Right.
And it's one side note that I saw about this particular Supreme Court case is that Elena Kagan has abstained or has recused herself for whatever reason. She's not participating in this decision, so that it could actually be a tie. There could be a 4-4 Supreme Court decision on this, which would leave it unresolved, I assume.
At the Supreme Court, what it would do is the decision from the lower court would stand.
Would stand.
Which would mean that, which would be in favor of the manufacturer.
Right. Hmm.
Well, I suppose you at the AMA are watching that very carefully, right?
Yeah, we actually signed on to an amicus curiae to the Supreme Court that was the lead author was the American Academy of Pediatrics, but the AMA has definitely supported that. We're very concerned, obviously, for the sake of public health.
Sure.
And research and development in new vaccines.
Well, that's great, LJ. I appreciate that. We have a few emails. Would you like to stick around while we read these?
Absolutely.
Because some of them actually you might be, in fact, the first one you would definitely be interested in.
Oh, yeah.
First one is from Anthony, who says, "Hi, thank you for your great program. I'm a material engineer organic chemist student, and I have developed an interest in virology while listening to your program."
You guys are great.
I found your program in Reddit, looking for good science podcast, while biking to work or during lectures. I'm still listening to the past episodes of TWIV, so I'm not sure if you already digested this information. I recollect that you spoke in your live podcast about the GlaxoSmithKline vaccine Pandremix having a new untested adjuvant. Now it seems that the adjuvant can cause narcolepsy in 12 to 16-year-old children. As there seems to be some evidence of narcolepsy being caused by an autoimmune disease, is it possible that the adjuvant causes an overreaction while trying to enhance the immune response, or could the inactivated virus be the main cause? I know this is a hard question that probably has no answers yet, but as a novice in virology, I'd like to hear what the experts have to say. Also, as the cases have emerged only in Finland and Sweden, whom both have quite homogeneous populations, could the amount of narcoleptic symptoms that seem to be higher than in normal influenza be caused by a mutation in the population, or could screening in these countries be different? Both have national health care for all. Thank you for all the good work you put into this. You know anything about this narcolepsy association, LJ?
No, you know what? I have not heard about that association with this adjuvant. I assume they're talking about the GSK adjuvant. That's the ASO4 adjuvant, because that's the adjuvant I believe that's actually in the HPV vaccine. That's
That's
out. That's been
used in the
recommended.
US, right?
Yeah, that's used in the U.S. So I don't. So I've not heard. It's an aluminum hydroxide based vaccine adjuvant, but I don't. I have not heard of any narcolepsy associated with that at all. So, I mean, it's clearly the adjuvant has been tested in Europe. It's actually in Europe and in other, as you say, in not only in the HPV vaccine, but also in the hepatitis B vaccine. And it's not, I haven't seen that association. So I don't know about the data
Yeah,
in
the
the Scandinavian countries.
this adjuvant. Let's see. Adjuvant ASO3 consists of DL-alpha tocopherol, vitamin E, squalene, and polysorbate 80.
Right.
Okay, is that the one he's talking about?
Yeah, that's the one
ASO3
that
then?
the
I'm sorry.
Pandemrix is
Okay.
the vaccine.
Okay. So that's what they use in their pandemic. Okay, I got confused with the ASO4, which is the one they use for HPV.
Okay.
I
Yeah, so this is a different.
seem to recall that these reports were then considered wrong, that there's no association. They did more analysis of the epidemiology and didn't find any association with narcolepsy. It says, as usual, in an early stage of the investigation, it may look like there's a association, but I think this turned out to be negative. You don't know anything about that, Alan? Have you heard?
I didn't come across this before, and hadn't seen it since. I'm just reading the thing on the Finnish website that Anthony sent the link to. And
Yeah, I haven't heard about it either, so that's cool. That's interesting.
let me send you actually this link, LJ. I can do that right in Skype, and you can have a look at it. Let's
Yeah, that'd be
see,
great.
LJ, text, start chat. Wonders of technology. Here you go. Here's the link to the story that he's talking about.
Okay, now I've got a whole
Okay.
bunch of hits from this site. I just searched the site for Pandemrix, and of course the hits are all in Finnish. Which how's your Finnish, LJ?
No, you've got Chinese, I can do that.
No, so
Oh,
a
that's interesting. So
did they actually halt immunization there?
they did. It
They
says that they
did
did.
for a time. And this thing that's that we got the link to is dated August 25th, but we don't know what happened after that. So if anybody out there can read Finnish, and they can go to the National Institutes for Health and Welfare in Finland website and maybe
I'll
try.
connect with some folks that I know, my colleagues at CDC, and see whether they've heard anything about this.
Yeah, there's an update here. No link. There's a story. No link between pandemrix and narcolepsy, which was from out of Sweden. No preliminary investigation has found no apparent link between the vaccine and neurological disorder, as many of recent cases never received the vaccine. This is from Sweden, from
Okay.
Swedish regulators. So as of September 9th, they had said, no, there's no
They said no
association.
link. Okay.
Anyway, if you get any more information on that, let us know, LJ. Okay, let's see. The next one's from Stan, and Stan is from Canada. Hello, I was listening to a previous episode of TWIV today and enjoyed a banter between yourself and Dick about virus transmission. The topic was that all viruses evolve towards increased transmission and away from lethality. Over time, it would be safe to assume that all viruses will eventually become something akin to rhinovirus, spreading like wildfire all through their host population, but rarely, if ever, killing a host. I thought of an interesting question I would like to ask. If all viruses evolve away from lethality, why did they evolve it in the first place? What about the lethal viruses that are around today? Why haven't they lost their lethality? Are they new viruses that haven't been given enough time to evolve? The only answer I could come up with when posing these questions to myself is that the viruses that can jump between species evolved to reduce lethality to their natural host, not their incidental host. That would only explain those viruses that can do so, but not viruses such as polio with only one host. I would be very interested to hear everyone's opinion, if an answer even exists.
It's great. That's something, obviously we've always talked about with regards to the fever trenches in 1918, right? I mean, one of the hypotheses why the 1918 influenza, Spanish flu, was so deadly was because it did not have to, quote unquote, devolve its virulence in order to improve its transmission, because it started in the battlefields of World War One and in the field hospitals in World War One, where the soldiers and their hosts were just right next to each other. And so the idea of having to devolve virulence so you don't kill your host too quickly was not as applicable. And that's one of the hypotheses to why, you know, the Spanish flu was so deadly. But I would say that, you know, that's something we all talk about. It's just one of those fun things to kind of throw your mind around, because the argument also would be that's the reason why HIV didn't have to devolve in terms of virulence, is because of the fact that it's not about virulence, it's about transmission. If the virus can transmit and transmit effectively, it doesn't have to lose virulence, because, you know, I would argue HIV is extremely virulent. It's just that it takes its time doing it.
Yeah, and I think when we've talked about this before, we've pointed out, or I have pointed out, that away from lethality is not necessarily an automatic part of the equation. I mean, as long as you're evolving toward increased transmission or toward preservation of the virus genome in the population, then that's the goal. So you can get things like yellow fever virus, which is ferociously lethal and over a very short time course. But it doesn't matter that the victim is immobilized and dying, because it's being spread by mosquitoes.
That's a great example. Mm. Yes, absolutely. So it's about transmission. If you can get it out and if you can keep going, it doesn't necessarily have to devolve. It doesn't have to lose its virulence.
It could be that for some of these viruses, it hasn't been long enough yet. So for HIV and flu, maybe they have only recently been in people and just need thousands and thousands of years. SIV in monkeys is avirulent because it's probably been in them for millions of years.
And as a broad generalization, I'd say zoonotic infections tend to be nastier than ones that have been in the same host for a while.
Yeah, when they jump into people from another animal, they're nasty. They're not evolved to exist with you. Polio probably jumped into people many, many years ago. So that host, who knows what it is, but it's so long ago that it's had time to evolve and be less virulent.
Right.
To the point where 99% of polio infections are insignificant. So I think you're on the right track. But again, every virus is slightly different, and there's no answer that's going to cover all of them. But I do think transmission is the key.
That used to be one of my favorite questions on the test I used to give to my kids when I was my students when I was teaching them. Which is your more deadly virus, Ebola or HIV, and tell me why?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Because you get a lot of great hypotheses coming out, you know, discussion points. So it's kind of fun. Yeah. It's an open-ended essay.
Let's do two more here, and then we'll wrap it up. This is from Kate. Hi, TWIV team. I love your podcast and the wealth of knowledge you make available to the general public. My question is about viruses that affect animals. Do animals experience viral infections in the same or a similar way as humans? In humans, usually there are physical symptoms that indicate a viral infection. Is this the same in all animals, or at least some animals? Thanks, and keep up the excellent podcasting and lame jokes. I love them. Well, some animals do get sick, sure.
And not all our jokes are lame.
Some of them are good. And some animals don't. So in some animals, virus infections are asymptomatic. And one that comes to mind is hantavirus infection of mice. It doesn't seem to affect the mice, but when it jumps into us, of course, causes serious respiratory disease. But I don't think we've looked at enough animals, natural infections in animals. We have put human viruses into animals, and sometimes they cause disease, sometimes not. So, for example, flu in mice and ferrets, depending on the strain, can cause disease. But naturally occurring infections of mice or other wild animals, we just don't know enough about that.
Now, if she's asking the question more generally, do animals have similar types of symptoms from their immune responses when they are having a major response to a virus? My answer would be that it depends on how closely related they are to humans. You know, mammals in general are going to have things like the histamine response or the cytotoxic response and the same components of their immune system. They're going to manifest themselves in similar ways. So if your dog is coughing and hacking and seems to have an infection, then that's probably very similar to you having a viral cold.
And dogs, of course, get dog flu.
Yeah.
Right.
Similar symptoms. So yes, some do. And then some natural infections have evolved so that there are no symptoms. But I suspect it's the same in humans. We have some virus infections which don't cause any symptoms in us either. So we're no different from other animals.
Really. Right, and animals that are further away, if you're talking about, well, when a fly gets a virus, then it's going to display very different symptoms, not only because it doesn't really have a nose to sneeze through.
That's right. Yeah, when you
I think it's interesting that we use ferrets for our animal models for influenza.
Yeah. I was told by Peter Pelezi years ago, because they have turbinates that are very much like human turbinates. You know, the tissues in your nose.
Really?
That's what he told me. There must be more to it than that.
I'm not going to doubt Peter Pelezi. That's what he
All right, our last email today is from Eric. Hey, guys, I've been listening to the podcast for a while now. I happened to cross it in iTunes, have been hooked ever since. I suppose you could say I'm writing this as a layperson since my background is in nursing and not microbiology. This thought occurred to me as you were talking about norovirus and the routes of transmission being the fecal-oral route. I have read elsewhere that the typical scent has a weight of about 760 nanograms. And I have also read that a typical virus weighs in at about 10 femtograms. You may see where I'm heading with this train of thought. For smell to have weight, it has to have substance. So I guess what I'm asking is the amount of fecal particulate past inflatus sufficient enough to transmit a significant viral load and possibly transmit norovirus? This may be the weirdest question and or hypothesis ever presented, but just like many things in life, you'll never know unless you ask. Keep up the great work. So you understand what he's asking here.
Yes, I think that question is floating in the wind now.
What do you think, LJ? Can you pass viruses in the gas?
Oh, I don't think I want to hesitate a guess on that one. I would say no.
I would say probably yes, although I don't know if that would be an efficient means of transmission for them.
It's probably not very efficient, but depending on how much you're shedding, you know, some of these norovirus infections, you shed 10 to the 11th per gram. So you can imagine.
You know what? I was thinking actually more about the some of the foodborne viruses too.
Yeah.
Like Norwalk-like viruses, you know, because you're right. There's a huge concentration in fecal matter.
I guess the other issue is the virus wouldn't be protected in any way.
By matter.
You know, it's not in a fluid, really. Yeah. It's just kind of floating, and most viruses are not going to do too well in that environment.
Yeah, I think it's probably theoretically possible. I haven't found any literature on it. I did look, but it's probably not very efficient because most of these are transmitted by contamination of food. You know, you don't wash your hands, you contaminate food, so you put a good amount of virus in there.
Yeah, and there's got to be a medium for which the virus to kind of, as Alan suggests, to be comfortable in.
Yeah.
And if it's coming out through the rectum, you got to imagine these are foodborne viruses, which are actually pretty stringent requirements.
Yeah.
In terms of survivability.
Interesting experiment to do, though. I don't know how you design it, but
if you could prove it one way or another, you might be up for an Ig Nobel Prize.
That's right. All right, that'll do it for email. Let's just wrap it up with a couple of picks of the week. Alan, what have you got?
My pick this week is an iApp. It's for iPhone, iPod, iPad, iPod Touch, what have you, called Biogene. And this is a nifty little tool. I now have an iPod Touch, so I can be one of those jerks who goes around saying, hey, there's this cool app.
So, hey, Rich Conda used to do that.
Yes, exactly. So now I'm like that. Biogene is a handy little widget that you plug a gene abbreviation or name into, and it pops up the full reference and database set for it. So you can read a summary of what this gene is known to do, references to the papers that demonstrated those activities. You know, so if you type in poliovirus receptor or what have you, you'll end up with a little synopsis of the research that's been done on it, what it's demonstrated, what other names it goes by, and database information, structure information where known. And just a very, very handy thing, I think, because inevitably you're reading along in something or listening to some talk and and somebody says, throws out a bunch of gene names, and the CD this hits CD that hits, you know, this, that, and the other, you say, well, gee, what is that? Hmm. So this, you just pop it into the app, and it gives you all that information.
That's nice. It's by Sloan Kettering.
Yeah.
I guess it's free, right?
Yeah, it's free.
That's beautiful. Everyone should get this. We'll put a link in the show notes. So if you're on the train and you want to know what a gene is, you just put it in there and you'll get it.
Yep.
That's just great. Biogene. Well, my pick, I've been waiting to pick for a long time. It was just published this week. It's the book called The Vertical Farm by Dixon Despommiers, one of the other hosts of TWIV.
And excellent.
It just was published on Tuesday, so you can get it. We'll put a link to that. Feeding the World in the 21st Century, his idea of building farms, hydroponic farms in skyscrapers. And it tells you all about the food problems that we're going to encounter in the next 50 years and how he thinks that vertical farming can solve it. So he told me not to pick this. He said it was too self-serving, but I think it's a great book. I've read it a long time ago. It's a great idea. Whether it works or not, we'll see. But if you're interested, check it out. The Vertical Farm.
Cool.
And that will do it for another TWIV. You can find us, of course, at iTunes, at the Zune Marketplace. And if you do pick one of those, do subscribe. It's great, and you get the episodes automatically. You can also listen with the Microbe World app, which is put out by ASM for iPhone and iPad. Check it out at the App Store. Or you can go to twiv.tv, where you can play the episodes, download them, and we also keep show notes. If you like TWIV, tell others about it. Links and reviews in iTunes are particularly helpful. And as always, send us your questions and comments to TWIV at twiv.tv. Alan is at alandove.com. Good to have you back.
Always good to be here.
LJ, so good to have you. LJ's at the American Medical Association. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this wonderful conversation. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
We have a good time. I hope you enjoyed it as well. You have been listening to This Week in Virology. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. Another TWIV is viral.